Spirit. Hi, everybody. My name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Chris.
Last week was a lot of fun. There was some great experiences shared about specific ninth step work, and I, for one, really appreciated hearing that. That kind of moves us through the ninth step, and we're looking at step 10 tonight. One thing I understand about step 10 is by the time you get to step 10, you've got some power. The practice of the first nine steps has really brought about some fundamental and some amazing changes in you if you've worked them the way it asks you to work them in this book. And so you get to step 10 and you've got some power. You have you've begun to develop a relationship with God, and you've begun to feel some power flowing in. You're able to do things that you weren't able to do before. You're starting to develop intuition. You're starting to be able to handle situations that used to cause you a lot of trouble. And a lot of things are taking place in your life. By the time you get to step 10, I'm going to start reading here. And this, you're going to find this about halfway down page 84. We had just read the ninth step promises, the promises that they read, and I don't know, probably one out of every three or four meetings around this area, somebody will read the promises. Those are basically the promises that happen to you as you set about cleaning up the wreckage of your past. Don't ever be confused and think the AA 12 promises, you get them after you get your brains back out of hock after 5 years or something. You have to work for those promises, and it actually requires making amends. You know, the 12-step process, I don't think any other place in the world besides amid a bunch of alcoholics would you find so many people in a 12-step fellowship that don't do the 12 steps and still feel that they're members like everybody else, you know, what's the big problem? And it even is worse than that sometimes. If you go to certain meetings or there are certain people in certain meetings and you share about actual step experience, people take exception to that, you know. I mean, it's happened to me over and over again. They think you're being smart or something, you know, actually talking about a 12-step recovery experience being in a 12-step fellowship. My own personal theory is that we've been infiltrated so heavily by well-meaning friends, the therapeutic community, the medical community, especially the rehabilitative community. So many people come out of their 28-day program filled with all kinds of stuff that they've learned in rehab and come in and that's what they think AA is. And anybody that I work with, I go about the task of helping them to unlearn most of the stuff that they've learned in rehab. There's been one of the great sayings that Bill Wilson had that I find makes a lot of sense is he used to say that the good is the enemy of the best. And if they tell you to not drink and go to meetings, that's good. Okay, if you have the power to do that. But if they tell you, don't drink, go to meetings, work a 12-step recovery program so that you can remain sober, that's better, you know. And a lot of the things that have infiltrated Alcoholics Anonymous over the years have been very, very good things. But what they've done is they've overshadowed the best. Up until about 30 or 40 years ago, coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, it was, I'm not going to say it was required, but I'm going to say it was very seriously suggested. You were encouraged in a very, very strong way to get involved in the 12-step recovery program. Today, it's okay for you to come into AA, sit in the back of the room, dump whatever you want to dump, so that hopefully that you'll leave the room lighter, and not get involved at all in any recovery methodology. And you're as much of an AA member as the person who's working a program. I'm not saying that that's necessarily a bad thing. I'm just saying that the fellowship has really taken the recovery program lighter and lighter as the years have gone by. And what seems to be happening in my estimation is our recovery statistics have plummeted. Even in this book, you'll see that there was 75% recovery rate back when this book was written. What do you think the recovery rate is today in Alcoholics Anonymous? I'll tell you right now, it's less than 10%. And there are places like Houston. Houston, Texas keeps track of the chips that they buy for celebrations in the Houston area. And they buy something like 20,000 desire chips a year. A desire chip is basically somebody who's going to walk up in front of the room and say, I desire to stay sober. I'm taking my 24-hour chip. We don't have that system up here. We basically, the first thing we celebrate is 90 days. But 20,000 desire chips. That means 20,000 times somebody walked up to the front of a room, you know, turned around and acknowledged the fact that they want to be in Alcoholics Anonymous and they want to stay sober. And they sold 14 30-year chips. What are those statistics? Anybody a mathematician? Whatever they are, they suck. You know what I'm saying? Where's everybody going? Okay?
14 and 20,000?
Yeah.
Got a better chance of hitting the pick four.
Yeah. So, you know, there's variables involved. I'm not saying this is an exact mathematical science, but it says something. It says something very, very powerful. I remember I was talking with Geraldine Delaney one time, and she said, you know what was different about AA in the old days than today? I said, no, what? She goes, in the old days, there was 10 old-timers for every newcomer. She goes, today, there's 10 newcomers for every old-timer. You know, where are all these, where's everybody going? Is there some kind of club that we don't know about? You know, is it I remember about 10 years ago, one of the questions that went through Intergroup was, where are all the old-timers going? Where are they going? And you know what the main answer was? There was many answers, but you know what the most significant answer for where were the old-timers going was? They were starting house meetings because they couldn't freaking stand to listen to the shit that goes on in discussion meetings anymore. They couldn't take it anymore, listening to the crap that gets shared. So they start house meetings. So all the real experienced AAs are disappearing. You know, this is what they discovered about 10 years ago. So again, just because in your rehab it was great to have group where you could share your feelings does not mean that that's a Alcoholics Anonymous discussion meeting is a proper forum to share your feelings like it's group therapy. We're not Happy Hills. We're Alcoholics Anonymous, and if you care enough to follow the text and the narrative of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, you'll see that there's a goal, and basically the goal is to recover and to help others. It doesn't say anything in here about slowly recovering. It doesn't say anything in here about getting your brains out of hock after 5 years and then taking another 5 to learn how to use them. As a matter of fact, it says much the opposite. It says you can be of help very, very quickly. So I'm off on a little bit of a rant here, but I do feel very, very strongly about working a 12-step program. I won't even sponsor anybody these days who's not willing to at least make a serious effort with the steps. I'm wasting my time, and most likely they're wasting theirs. If they're truly alcoholic and don't work through the steps, here's what's going to happen. Let's say you really are an alcoholic and you come in and you want to do the fellowship, you want to become meeting dependent. Anybody in here know people that are meeting dependent? Oh, I missed two meetings in a row. I'm a basket case. You ever hear about people like that? That's somebody that's meeting dependent. Right? It doesn't say anything in this book about being meeting dependent. As a matter of fact, it says quite the opposite. And some of our earlier texts say meetings are optional. Step work is essential. Share that at the next closed-minded discussion meeting, you know, and see what happens. All the meeting-dependent people will take exception to that. Anyway, here's what's going to happen if you're a true alcoholic and you go to AA and you don't work the steps. The fundamental experience that you get from AA will not be sufficient to keep you coming and to keep you enthusiastic about Alcoholics Anonymous enough to keep coming. Here's another general statistic that I'm not saying at all that it's scientific, but it's about right. Forget about the first 5 years of sobriety, everybody's first 5 years, because what happens is there's tons of heavy drinkers that come in here, and they realize after a while that, you know, that Alcoholics Anonymous is probably a little extreme for their case, and they wander off, and they do fine. But let's say you've been here 5 years. You've figured out by that time that you're alcoholic, and you're going to stay. For the people over 5 years, 50% of them have under 10 years. And for the people over 10 years, 50% of them have under 15 years. And for the people over 15 years, probably 70% of them have under 20 years. Do you see where I'm getting? We're losing half of our fellowship every 5 years. And I believe we're losing it because the fundamental Alcoholics Anonymous experience is not sufficient to keep the individual participating. And that's what I see happening with people who are able to stay sober and not do the steps. People I see do the steps, and I know this from my own experience because I've worked with a lot of people. The people that have gone through the steps are still here, all of them. And they're working with other people. They're good members of their home group, and they're able to keep their eye on the ball to the point where they understand their priorities. They understand how important consistency is. And they're able to keep up the enthusiasm necessary to continue to participate year after year after year after year. And that's what I see. I've certainly observed that in my stay here in Alcoholics Anonymous. This thought brings us to step 10. Which suggests that we continue to take personal inventory, fourth step, and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. That's step 9. We vigorously commenced this way of living as we cleaned up the past. Another 9th step. We have entered the world of the Spirit. I love that. There's an instruction in this book. Whenever you read a spiritual term, ask yourself what it means to you. What does living in the world of the Spirit mean to you? That would be a good meditation. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. This is not an overnight matter. It should continue for our lifetime. Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. Where did you see that? You saw that in your four-column inventory. When these crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. That's 6 and 7. We discuss them with someone immediately. That's step 5. And we make amends if we've harmed anyone. That's like the 4th time they've pointed you in the 9th step direction. Then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. That's step 12. Love and tolerance of others is our code. What I see this step is, and how I try to practice this step, and how I try to guide the people that I work with toward toward the practice of this step is basically it's a reactive step. We've learned a lot of tools how to handle personal relationships, how to handle situations, how to deal with our emotions, you know, how we put them on paper when we're resentful or fearful or remorseful. We've learned a lot of skills by the time we get to step 9. I believe that step 10 is asking us to use the tools that we've learned in the previous 9 steps reactively where appropriate. In other words, let's say Scooter said, Chris, what was wrong with you last week? You sounded like an idiot. My first thought is going to be, God damn, son of a bitch. What the hell is he talking about? I'm going to react resentfully. However, if I'm awake to step 10, what I'm going to do is I'm going to say column 1, Scooter. Column number 2, criticize me. What does it affect? Does it affect my self-esteem? Yeah, it affects my self-esteem. Does it affect my personal relationships? Yes, it does. Does it affect my pride? Yeah, I feel stupid. All right, what's my part in it? Well, last week, you know, I was a little bit under the weather. I wasn't really focused. I didn't do any preparation. Scooter was right. All right, I've gone through the 4th step. If appropriate, I'll talk to somebody about it. I'll ask God I'll become willing and ask God to remove the character defect of pride and self-centeredness that's attached to me, my attachment to what Scooter thinks, which is ridiculous anyway. You know, our attachments sometimes to what other people think, it's really bizarre when you really look at it. And probably, I would probably owe him some kind of an amends. And it depends on how many people I ran around the room saying that he was a scumbag to. You know what I mean? So I've gone through the steps on this, and I've learned how to handle the situation better. Rather than be mad at him the rest of our lives and never have another thing to do with him, I would be able to move through the process of the steps, get to the other side, see where I was at fault, take responsibility for where I'm at fault. That usually grants me the freedom from the resentment, and everything's fine. So I'll use step 10 in a situation like that. Let's say this actually happened to me one time. I gave a $50 bill to a merchant, and they gave me change for $100, and I walked away. I ended up going back and making direct amends to the person for that. Mary Beth was talking, I think she was talking last week, maybe not at this meeting, but she was talking about a really great 10-step experience, and I was going to have her share that tonight, but she's not here, so I'll take the liberty of sharing it myself, and as long as nobody in here tells her. She was on the phone with one of her clients, and one of her clients, very demanding, abrasive, you know, always worried about 10 cents kind of client. And she said the wrong thing to Mary Beth, insulted her a couple of times. And I know from personal experience that that's not the best move. And she started freaking out on this lady. And I was in the other room, and I'm just like, oh, man. I mean, freaking out on her. And this is a client who's going to pay her $3,000 for this job, so it probably wasn't all that appropriate. And she gets done hollering at her, slams the phone down, comes into the bedroom and wants me to co-sign a lot of this stuff. And she was going through the process. She was very, very angry. But what I saw was in about a 5-minute period of time, I saw her from being justifiable anger to I have to call her up and make an amends. And I saw how the process worked. And it was just a beautiful example of a 10-step. Now, when you're making amends in the 9th step, it's appropriate a lot of times to have the cards and talk it over with your sponsor. But the reactive 10-step amends can be done on the phone. It can be done in person. But what it needs to be is it needs to be done promptly. So whatever hastens that amends and still allows you to communicate it properly is probably okay. You don't have to go up to them and say, "I'll never get over my drinking if I don't, you know, if I'm not willing to set right the path." I mean, that's really not necessary in a 10-step. You need to be more reactive. So I got to see her change from being from justifiable resentment, go through the point where she was looking at what it was affecting, then getting to the point where she was wrong, realizing that she needs to take responsibility for where she's wrong, or she's not even going to sleep that night, kind of thing. You know, I mean, that's what happens with a lot of alcoholics who've been sober a while and who've started practicing programs. We don't have the emotional fortitude that we used to have when we used to just run around like a tornado. We're more sensitive to where we're at fault, and we're more sensitive to when we need to make amends. She calls the woman back, and she said that she was wrong. She did not say she was sorry. She said, "I yelled at you. I reacted very inappropriately, and I was wrong. Everything was fine." And she came back into the bedroom and laid down on the bed and said, like, whew, you know. I mean, she felt good about what she did. If she didn't do that 10-step amends, I can tell you she would have suffered all night long and probably for days to come. So it's about our spiritual condition. Step 10 is about our spiritual condition, and it's about applying the spiritual exercises that we've gotten experience with in the first 9 steps and applying them in our life so that we have fewer collisions, so we have better relationships, healthier relationships, and probably first and foremost that we're maintaining our spiritual condition, which is a requirement for permanent sobriety if you be alcoholic. Let's see what else it says in here. Here are some great 10-step promises. Now, you hear the 9-step promises read all the time. Has anybody here ever been to a meeting where they read the 10-step promises as part of the opening preamble? No. Why do you think? Why do you think they never read the 10-step promises? Could it quite possibly be that very few people finish their amends and firmly move into step 10 and experience these things? I think that might be true. I actually have gone to a meeting. The Free Spirit Group in Brooklyn reads the 10-step promises. They do a lot of things that are very, very cool there. That's one of them. Anyway, here they are. So, like all the promises in this book, you have to assume that you've actually done this step. They don't materialize if you don't work for them. And we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol. My friend Larry from Staten Island told me on the phone the other day, and he clipped me right at the knees with this. He said, "Chris, if you're still angry with people, or if you're still arguing with people, or if you're still fighting with anybody, you haven't recovered." Whoa. You know, that's a strong one, huh? "For by this time, sanity will have returned." That's a highlight, you know, if you're like some of the guys I've worked with in the past. "We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as if from a hot flame. We will react sanely and normally, and we will find that this has happened automatically." This is actually the antidote for the stuff that they went over in the chapters early in the book, more about alcoholism, and there is a solution. In those chapters, it basically painted a picture of hopelessness that was very bleak. You have a mind that will convince you to pick up alcohol, whether you want to or not. Doesn't matter what the consequences are. Doesn't matter how much you want to stay away from booze. Powerless is powerless. If you could just decide not to drink, can you admit to powerlessness? No, you're not an alcoholic if you can just decide not to drink. Because one of the requirements for being an alcoholic is an admission of powerlessness. So if there's anything you can do to keep from drinking, you're not powerless. Let's say you stay away from booze by going to 422 meetings a week. Can you really admit to powerlessness? No, I'm going to those meetings. That's keeping me sober. You know, you can't admit to powerlessness. The true alcoholic is screwed. The true alcoholic has to admit that the obsession of the mind is beyond anything that they can do, and that the allergy of the body is something that will never change. So if you react sanely and normally, that means that you're not thinking insane. They talked about the mental obsession materializing as strange mental blank spots or the subtle forms of insanity that precede the first drink. So that's really the crux of our problem. By step 10, that problem has been removed. We will see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That's the miracle of it. We're not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. Remember, we used to fight alcohol head on by just gritting our teeth and saying we're not going to drink? That's a head-on battle that we always lost. But you can go around the back by working these spiritual exercises. You can develop a spiritual condition. You can align yourself with a higher power, and the problem will be removed. Very, very unorthodox treatment for an illness, by the way. I think that's another reason why we lose so many people initially, because it's so hard to believe this. The newcomer will come in, and they will be a month away from a court case that may land them in jail for 5 years. They've got a wife that's thrown them out of the house. They've got a job they're about to be fired from. Their family hates them. They're in debt to loan sharks for $100,000, and they start working with you, and you tell them, just go to a meeting and come over to my house later and we'll talk about step one. And they're like, what part of my problem don't you understand? You know, what the hell is a meeting going to do? Three Finger Louie's coming over later for his $100,000. And we're like, look, that'll take care of itself. I'd like you to just work on step one right now. And they look at you like you're crazy. It's an unorthodox treatment. We feel as though we've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We've not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor are we afraid. That is our experience. That is how we react so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. So those are the promises that we were really looking for when we first came to AA. The separation from alcohol promises. Again, I don't believe that you're safe and protected from alcohol until you're firmly in step 10 and you've worked the previous 9 steps. It does not say that the problem has been removed until you're at step 10. That means if you have not done the first 9 steps, if you still have unfinished amends, if you are not using step 10 as a discipline, you're rolling the dice. If you're really an alcoholic, how do you know if the obsession of the mind is gonna manifest in you while you're driving to your 785th AA meeting? How do you know? I've seen a lot of people go back out with a lot of time in the last couple of years. A few of them with over 25 years sober go back out. People that were still going to meetings consistently. You know, how do you know that the obsession of the mind's not going to clip you? I've never seen anybody who's gone through the steps and continue to practice the principles of the steps and then is active in service ever drink again. They fall short somewhere, you know. So anyway, I believe that these promises are true. I am safe and protected today from alcohol. I am. I know I am. Now, I can't go too much into the future because I just don't know how much effort I'm going to continue to put into the maintenance of my spiritual condition. But I believe if I continue to maintain my spiritual condition, the grace of God is going to be operative on me. You know, I do my part. God does his part. And that's it. It just works that way. Again, try to explain that to a newcomer. well, it's, you know, it's God's going to do it, but you have to do it. You know, if you don't do it, God doesn't do it. And they'll be like, you know, it's very difficult. That's what makes a good sponsor, somebody that can explain things like that so that people can understand them. Anyway, here's a great paragraph. It is easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. Laurels are yesterday's accomplishments, by the way. We are headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. We're not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Every day is a day that we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. How may I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. These are thoughts which must go with us constantly. We can exercise our willpower along this line all we wish. It's the proper use of the will. Again, they talked about earlier in this book that willpower is useless against alcohol. And that's another thing that will confuse newcomers, because there's probably been many, many experiences that they've had where they decided not to drink and they didn't drink. You know, we've been able to do that. I'm swearing off alcohol for Lent, and maybe you make it, you know. But hasn't there also been experiences where you've said to yourself, I'm just not going to do it again, and you did it again? You know, that's in my experience. And let me ask you this. Let's say you did sometimes have power over whether you drank or not, and sometimes you didn't. Were you the one who was in charge of when those times would be? You know, no. It usually happened at the absolute worst possible point. You know, over at the in-laws' house, you know, or some crazy thing. You end up getting blithering drunk. Much is already said about receiving strength, inspiration, and direction from Him who has all knowledge and power. If we have carefully followed directions, and again, I want to talk just a little bit about directions before we move on. Bill Wilson was writing this book, and he was getting a lot of input. As a matter of fact, the meetings per se, you know, the times the alcoholics were getting together amongst themselves, a lot of the meeting time was taken up reading the chapters Bill was writing and arguing about them. Can you imagine? Can you imagine everybody in this room, we're writing a text for Alcoholics Anonymous. How many of us would be arguing with each other about what was in there? Or, you know, don't put that, put this. Or I think this is more important than that. And it was absolutely driving Bill crazy. The first three, maybe four chapters. Was it? No, I'm sorry. The first five chapters he wrote with input from the groups. And it was battles. I mean, it was insane. And he got to a point where he just couldn't take it anymore. And he went back to the groups and he said, look, either I write this book my way or else you guys can write it. But I'm not bringing the chapters in and we're not going to battle this thing out. I just can't take it anymore. And what happened was, the groups got together and they didn't want Bill to write the chapters without their input. But they didn't want to write the book more. So they finally acquiesced and they finally said, all right, Bill, you go ahead and you write it your way. So you'll see the difference from chapter 5 to chapter 6 as far as directions. They're suggestions in the first five chapters. And then finally when Bill got to write it the way he wanted to write it, he put directions right back in, which is what he meant anyway. You know what I mean? And this is on one of the Bill Wilson tapes that I've heard. So it's not just my theory. Anyway, if we've carefully followed directions, we've begun to sense the flow of His Spirit into us. Here's another one. You know, what does that mean to you? It's a spiritual term. What exactly does that mean to you? Have you felt the Spirit flow into you? How has that happened to you? To some extent, we become God conscious. We have begun to develop this vital sixth sense. But we must go further, and that means more action. So again, I believe that they touch on all the other steps in step 10. They even talk a little bit about about establishing contact with God, which is step 11, and trying to seek to do God's will. In the very, very early days of Alcoholics Anonymous, there was several places where they could learn about spiritual programs, spiritual practices, and how they would help alcoholics. One of them was the Oxford Group, obviously, but there was other ones. There was the Emmanuel Group. There were evangelical religious organizations all over the place. There was even the temperance movement, which is something we don't talk a lot about today. But the temperance movement was basically a church-based movement that was, its sole purpose really was to pull people away from alcohol, the demon alcohol. And what they would try to do is they'd try to get you when you're young, and you would sign an oath, a Bible oath, that you were gonna, you were not gonna partake of the evil spirits. And there were many different ways that the temperance movement reacted against alcoholism. Probably alcoholism was worse than it is today in the mid-1800s. It was just horrific for periods of time back then. The amount of alcohol consumed per capita back then was probably double of what it is today. There was just a lot, alcoholism was a lot more rampant. There was less to do, probably. But, you know what I mean?
TVs, movies, video games, or computers.
Right. But one of the things, like the temperance movement was just dying out around the time of Alcoholics Anonymous's beginnings. But there were reactive movements in the temperance movement whereby they would try to help drunkards. And they would drag them into the churches and they would Jesusify these people. And they'd dip you and dunk you and pray over you and hang crosses over your head. And there were many times that this actually worked. You know, there were many, many recoveries that took place. It usually was consistent with the people getting enthusiastic about religion and becoming consistent with participation in the religious ritual that would give them better odds staying sober. So, you know, Bill Wilson didn't make a lot of this stuff up. People knew back then that there was hope for the hopeless alcoholic. There wasn't a lot of hope, but the hope usually was to be found in religious conversion experiences. We don't call what AA does to you a religious conversion experience. That's what they called it back in the early days. But what they did was they took the religious specifics out and left the spiritual principles. The spiritual principles are what works anyway, not necessarily the religious liturgy. And that's really what we have. And step 10 is a way of applying those tried and true spiritual principles that you can find in every decent religion and every decent philosophy. And it's a way to apply them to your life. If you apply them to your life, you participate in the maintenance of your spiritual condition. If your spiritual condition is maintained, you are safe and protected against alcohol. I'll stop here for tonight. I'll turn the meeting over to Scooter, and next week we'll get into step 11. Thanks.
Thanks, Chris. And we now open the floor for discussion, questions.